Welcome to another episode of Livewire's Rules of Investing. I'm your host and editor at Livewire, Patrick Polk. Today, I'll be chatting with Giselle Roux, Chief Investment Officer at Escala Partners. Giselle is one of Australia's most respected investment strategists, with 20 years of experience on both the buy and sell sides at JB Were, Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, and Citigroup. We'll discuss where we are in the current rate cycle, how to invest as rates rise, and whether the Fed can manage a rate hike cycle without causing a recession. I hope you enjoy the show. Well, look, Giselle, it's lovely to be with you here today. It's been, I think, about 12 months or so since we last caught up. I believe, if I recall correctly, one of the big issues you were discussing at the time was inflation, and that's definitely now on the front of every investor's mind. So I'd love to just get straight into it and hear what your current views are. At the end of 2016 on Livewire, when we caught up with you, you said that inflation would be the biggest driver of markets for the year ahead. It appears to be playing what's playing out now. Would you say that that's your view? It is your view playing out?
Well, to be fair, the inflation numbers still look tremendously subdued. Certainly using a CPI measure, probably the bigger impact has been the sense that the output gap is closing, in other words, the spare capacity in something like the American economy and the German economy in particular is no longer there. We've seen strong employment numbers. And, you know, inflation tends to be a lagging indicator, so we're still waiting for the actual inflation spike to occur. But the pricing in the market seems to suggest that from a very low level, inflation is almost certain to rise, and structurally it has to rise, just there's some mechanics behind it that will make it rise this year in the US. And it's that certainty now in bond pricing that's really driving the market behaviour.
What about the Fed? They seem fairly set, their eyes are fairly well set on inflation, that you wouldn't accuse them of ignoring it. Do you think that markets are pricing in the right number of rate hikes, or they've traditionally been a little bit too, they've gotten a bit ahead of things, but I just wonder, are they behind things at the moment?
You could argue that they're perhaps slightly behind. Well, put it this way. The market is pricing in 3 rate hikes and a 30% possibility of 4 rate hikes. The Fed dots seem to imply 3 rate hikes. So we're not far off. Nobody at this stage is tremendously wrong in terms of what the implications for pricing. But both of those, both the Fed dots move around, and we still have got 3 members of the Fed that have not been appointed. So who knows where the dots will really end up. And the market's quite fickle. You know, if a data point comes out robust, it reprices that 3 to 4 quite quickly, 4 versus 3. But I think there's an almost unanimous view that 3 are the most likely outcome. That would not be a surprise. And 4 would be a modestly higher number, but not hugely so that you would think most people will be disrupted in their view. That being said, I'm not convinced that all asset markets are pricing in that directly. So it's all very well to say the futures market in rates is pricing it, but whether it's correctly priced into all other assets is not that clear.
So I was wondering if you could explain how it is that the US rates affect other assets, particularly, you know, equities, infrastructure, things like that. And how is it that, why are the interest rates so important to those assets?
It's a really, really important issue. And to some extent, you need to say, look at the last 5 years where falling rates have meant that asset prices of long-dated cash flow streams have been higher valued. You've seen this typically in things like utility companies, property prices, that kind of thing. In simple terms, what you do is in the future, when you know you've got an income stream arriving somewhere 5, 10, maybe even 20 years later, you discount that back at a certain rate. So if you assume that you're discounting it back at 3%, that's a fairly low discount rate. In other words, the erosion of real value of money is quite modest. If you think it's going to be 4%, the erosion of real value of money is higher and the asset should be less today. And so you've actually seen that very distinctly in equity markets in particular, where the property trust sector, the REIT sector, and the utility sector have actually given negative or very low performance this year, and that is the long-dated nature of those kind of assets, and therefore they are less attractive theoretically now than what they were when interest rates were falling and the arithmetic was working the other way.
Excellent. Well, just staying on the topic of inflation for a little bit longer, I'd be curious to know how the recent developments in the US have affected your views. There's obviously, there's been tariffs, there's been tax cuts, and certainly not what you would call counter-cyclical, I guess. And also, there's the other issue that you raised just a moment ago of just the lack of appointments that are happening to important public offices. How do you think this whole political situation in the US is affecting the rates at the moment?
Well, let's take the tax issue first, because that's already implemented and is impacting, and the Fed, the new head of the Fed, Powell, has commented on that. So he has said that that is a stimulatory measure. He hasn't cast a value judgment on it, but the implication seems to be that he's suggesting this is a stimulatory measure when the economy is already running on quite a sound pace. And I think that's why the market's been prepared to price up to 4 rate hikes, saying possibly one more than what the dots would imply if that strength from the tax cuts actually does fold its way into sufficient activity. Tariffs, at the moment we don't know exactly what's going to happen on that front either, so if you like, uncertainty reigns supreme, as you indicated. Tariffs could increase the inflation rate in America, which would be another reason for rates to go up more than what's currently pricing. So by and large, the uncertainty is creating the possibility that rates will go up more than expected, or not the uncertainty, but the type of policy measures that it looks like the Trump administration is leaning towards would suggest rates more than expected. But, you know, whether the Fed has to play an apolitical role, you know, whether they prefer to err on the side of caution, you know, you still have to give a half bet to that, which is maybe why this sort of 3.5 rates is possibly correct.
I'm curious a little bit about how you do invest in an environment like this. You know, so you mentioned before that long-dated assets are probably not the right place to be. What looks good in an environment of rising rates?
Yeah, well, it's fairly obvious that fixed income assets don't look good. So, and you've seen almost universally people recommending not to hold bonds, for example. Some people are still comfortable in credit markets and floating rate kind of help. So you've seen fixed income underweight and where it is, be either in certain types of credit or in floating rate. But it makes it quite hard to have an appropriate fixed income portfolio, which is typically your defensive part of your portfolio. Implicitly, people are holding on to the equity market because the TINA, there is no alternative. You could go into other assets. We can talk about them if you like. But so we've seen equity markets maintain their strength a little bit, I think, simply because bonds are not attractive. So as I say, you've got to allocate your money somewhere. As a pension fund, you will use equities. That being said, also, equity earnings look really robust this year. The sort of impacts of economic growth and the leverage to the cycle are coming through. The question is more which sector and possibly which region you favour at this point. And there's a degree of diversity of views across that level.
Okay. Well, let's talk about closer to home then. There doesn't seem to be as much pressure to raise rates in Australia. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think there's no question that the RBA makes positive noises but doesn't have any inclination at the moment. And quite simplistically, they can lean on the view that inflation here remains very subdued, wages growth has definitely not come through yet, and therefore there's no natural trigger for them to raise rates.
Okay, so given that scenario where you've got the US raising rates and Australia presumably staying relatively flat, we're already in a situation now where the rates are pretty close to even with each other. What does it mean for the Australian economy and for investors here in the Aussie dollar if we do see the US rates get above Australian rates, which traditionally, other than a brief period, I think about 15 years ago, traditionally we've seen the Aussie has always offered higher rates than in the US.
Well, it's just briefly touching on the Australian economy in terms of a rate perspective, so not regarding what's happening in the US. I think the RBA's commented often enough on the high indebtedness of the household sector. So to raise rates here, they really need confidence that wages growth is going to accelerate so that people aren't worse off than what they were before. So that is part of the waiting game. We've been very fortunate that in the meantime, infrastructure spending has crept up enough to compensate for that, and the economic outlook looks respectable without being terrific. The dollar, or let's put this at currencies, I mean, remember we're always talking about the cross currencies, we're still down against the euro and the yen, so it's really, we always tend to refer back to the US dollar, but that is the one where US rates, as you say, have gone up, Australian rates have not, and we're now at the 10-year, roughly to an equivalent level, and in theory, you could have seen more Australian dollar weakness, but instead what you've seen is US dollar weakness. And there's a whole raft of reasons behind that. Some people point to the current account deficit in America, which will expand quite a lot. The fiscal deficit, which given the tax cuts have exacerbated that outcome. So that means that the US has got a lot of funding to do and will be issuing a lot of treasuries. So there's going to be a lot of dollar issuance in the market for it to absorb. There's simply our flows out of the US into other areas because growth is strong. So why be in the defensive US dollar phenomena when you can be in emerging economies, for example, and take your currencies elsewhere? So there's more influence than just rates. And the commentators seem to suggest that maybe if you get to, you know, this 3-4 basis point rate hikes rather in America, and you don't get any elsewhere, the US dollar may eventually be dragged up just by the rate differential. But you know, there is just simply looking at rate differential is not a sufficient condition for currencies. It's not the single contributing factor.
Okay. I hope you don't mind if we go a little bit off script for a bit here. One of the questions that occurred to me when you were talking just a moment ago was around this idea of rising rates. If you look at traditionally, whenever we've gone through a major rate hike cycle, at least over the last 20 or 30 years, it's been the trigger for a recession or a sell-off or at least a fairly major correction. Do you think that's what's going to happen here, or do you think the Fed can actually manage this in a way that avoids that outcome?
The cynics say that the Fed can never be precise enough. You know, the sort of Goldilocks position for the Fed is very hard for it to establish because the data sets it gets are backward-looking and the behavioural characteristics of economies and the economic development, you know, so you say, for example, consumer behavior, at what point is there a trigger where too much rates is just too much for them? So that makes it really hard for the Fed to be mechanistic enough just on the rate side of the equation. So if you go by history, to your point, is you say that rate hike cycles tend to eat the lunch of the economy and the economy softens usually more than expected before the rates get pulled back again so that the economic cycle can re-emerge from that. It probably, you know, you'd be foolish to bet against that this time. Why should that be any different? The only redeeming feature seems to be is that everybody's so cognizant of this being the issue that my read would be is when we get the downturn, which, let's be honest, you know, nothing continues forever, it much more likely is to be quite a soft downturn because we're not going to get that extremity of cycle that we had before. So I would argue it's like a mini 94. Now, in 94, the rates went up 300 basis points. We're not going to get even remotely close to that, but economies are much more sensitive to rates. That was really a one-year to even, I don't even think it was a full one-year phenomena in terms of seeing both bond and equity markets not performing well. And after that, we emerged in a period of quite strong growth for the rest of the 90s. And I'm not saying we're going to go back to the strong growth either, but it feels like it's much more likely to be one of the sort of sluggish slowdowns, bottoming a bit, things just being retweaked, and we can continue at this sort of relatively moderate growth cycle than what we've been. Of course, there are many, many other factors that could come into play as well. You know, you've mentioned politics, counterparties we don't necessarily have as good an understanding as what we used to as in the past. So there may be other factors that are unknown, but that's sort of the generic description.
You mentioned before when we were discussing there's no alternative to equities. Bonds don't look particularly attractive, but you said, there are some other asset classes that do look interesting. So in this kind of environment, what does look interesting to you?
I'll be honest, I still think it is predominantly generic equities. It sounds very boring and dull because everybody's been hammering that for some time. But I still think there are such fascinating themes in the corporate sector that if you've got some patience in mind, anything from automation, alternative energy, a whole host, a huge change in financial services that we're likely to experience in the next 10 years. Those are still such interesting parts that you don't want to discourage, just trying to finesse timing of getting into equities or trying to call these things. I think I would be reluctant to finesse that. Bear in mind that what we call alternatives, we actually rather prefer to say it's just a different approach to investing. So for example, if you buy private equity, the word equity is still there. It is an equity cycle. Okay? So it's an equity. You're buying an equity capital part of that business. Just because it's not listed doesn't mean to say it's lower risk, for example. You're looking at a different approach. The ones that probably are most appealing to investors at this stage, saying I'd like to participate in equity-like, so growth assets, but I don't want the full risk of that. So you look at either a market neutral, in other words, we're not taking a directional view in the market, or something called a long short, in other words, it's a short position which will cover some of the downside for you. In fixed income markets, some people have gone to the less typical fixed interest. This would be what's called mezzanine debt, so lending outside of the banking system. It requires quite a level of good judgment and understanding of the risk, but certainly the pickup in yield is there for investors to look at. So those which we would call the more alternative or other ways of approaching straightforward equities and bonds.
From the perspective of looking at, factors, value versus growth kind of dichotomy, which I don't want to get into that too much, but from a market point of view, would you say that one of the other of those styles might be favoured in this kind of environment?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question, and there's pages being written on it at the moment. Typically, when you have a strong economic cycle, your so-called value stocks should do well. They are leveraged to that economic cycle, so these are stocks where the operating margins have been crunched during some kind of downturn. Economic growth improves because they are demand rises, their costs don't go up, and you get these big profit improvements coming out of these kind of companies. We've not seen that. The value component of the market has remained very subdued, and the market still seems particularly, or investors rather than the market, married to so-called growth and quality. So that's your internet type stocks and your so-called quality stocks. So it's really hard to know whether people don't believe that the economic cycle is going to be strong enough to support leveraging companies. That's probably one element of it. And secondly, that the last 5 years have done so well for people in those internet companies, the reluctance to let go of that is absolutely embedded into the psyche of investors these days. I think people need to think carefully about that sort of barbelling type approach. To some extent, I would encourage people who've got a very, very strong growth orientation to add a little bit of value, because that could be the surprise factor. And conversely, those that are you know, should, if you've got a long-term time horizon, you still should think always of investing in those kind of growth companies, because as I say, those kind of, you know, the new word, disruptive type companies, you can't, they still feel as though they are going to be long-term winners because their positioning is so strong these days.
Just from a structural point of view, yeah.
Yeah, they're just dominating. Some of them are just really dominating. I mean, the question really comes down to price. You know, how do you value these companies, and how do you long, do you anticipate this very high growth that they're achieving to be sustained? And there, I think, is an interesting, and you perhaps be more sceptical that the you know, the click and drag type forecast, if it's doing 20% this year, do 20% forever. Realistically, we know that's not the case. The law of large numbers gets to you.
Definitely an issue that Google's probably going to be facing over the next few years.
Yeah. You know, if I may, just as an aside, these companies have been put into the IT sector. This week there was an announcement that the sector are going to change, and these companies are going to go into consumer discretionary over the next 12 months. So it's going to be a large restructuring of where stocks sit, which probably more appropriately affects what they do, because Google is not, strictly speaking, an IT company. It's a consumer company. It's an advertising company. You know, so they will go into other sectors. It doesn't change anything else about them, but it does mean people may look at them through a slightly different lens than what they did at the moment.
Yeah, there's certainly going to be a few fund managers out there who I think will be very happy about that change. look, I wanted to open up the floor to you now and ask you about whatever you want, essentially. So usually this is part of one of our regular questions, but I feel like this is an area that you know, you're particularly strong at in, so I wanted to make it part of our main interview. So what would you say is the biggest risk out there in markets today that's not really on investors' radars?
I think most people don't understand what drives their portfolios, how sensitive they are to interest rates, or, you know, a similar risk factor across their portfolios. Whether they've, for example, taken too much risk on dividend streams from the Australian market. Nothing against dividend streams. It's all a question of how much risk you take in any, you know. They used to say certainty is death and taxes. Well, taxes has probably become one of the great uncertainty these days. So to construct a portfolio which is dependent on a tax regime being maintained forever, I think is a dangerous outcome. Similarly, to assume that interest rates will remain high or low, I think people should allow for parts of the portfolio that they've got to be, if they're subdued. I always say to people, if everything's performing all at the same time, you've got a dangerous portfolio. There should be parts of your portfolio which are just marking time, and they should not be bad parts of the portfolio. They, if they're the rightly designed, they will be the ones that will help you out when the rest of your portfolio is more sensitive to changing dynamics. So, you know, there's too many simple answers about one dimension in portfolios, I still think, today.
Great. Look, I will move on to our regular questions now. So this is supposed to be a little bit of fun. So if you could go back in time to when you were finishing school or university and give yourself one piece of investing advice, what would it be?
I think the discipline to sell both on the up and the downside. In other words, when things have run strongly and your instinct says they possibly might be overvalued, and you've got to have some kind of valuation lens on things. I don't see how you invest if you haven't got some notion about what valuation sits behind these things. So being prepared to either lighten off, you know, trim it back if the valuation, and being patient about that. And similarly, our behavioral attitude to holding on to something, hoping it will get right in the long run, if it's flawed, it won't. Holding on to something just because it hasn't performed well in a reasonable time, might be 2 years, that's not bad. That might just be that one thing that you're waiting for to trigger, and portfolios should be there for long term. But holding on to things which you hope will get fixed, I'd leave that to somebody else to worry about. You opportunity cost of doing that compared to investing in things which you have greater faith in is almost always outweighed by that. So knowing when to sell, or understanding why and when to sell.
Just curious if I could delve into a little bit more detail there. So how do you think about how you separate the... So when you're talking about something that's performing poorly, you know, you've got a big red mark in your portfolio. What is the thing that differentiates something you'd be looking to sell from something that you'd be looking to hold on to?
Well, the number of questions you can ask yourself is, would you buy today? Yeah, so if I look at something that I've got in my portfolio and say, would I still be prepared to put money in that today? If the answer is yes, it's probably something I should just hold on to, because that implies to me I'm still think that the thesis is makes sense. If I say, well, I'm not sure, I'll wait, that implies you should sell, because that suggests you're waiting. You've got a sufficient uncertainty not to know what it is. And just be sure you do have some understanding about what the original thesis was in the first place.
Great. One last question for you. So if the market was going to close for a few years starting from tomorrow, and you could only invest in, you could only hold one investment, what would it be?
Okay, well, on the basis that equity markets are relatively expensive, and as we go through this change in the rate cycle, we may face a period of a downturn in equities. I would still, ironically, invest in equities, mainly because I'm going to hold it for more than 2 years, but I would hold unhedged global equities, because even though it won't redeem it entirely, I think it's reasonable to assume that the Australian dollar will behave badly, if I can put it that way, in an economic downturn. We're very sensitive to economic conditions here, and so at least it will buffer the degree of reduction in value that I experience, and you know, at that point I can make decisions if I wish. But you know, because I think equities to me still seems the most reasonable place for long-term returns, and global equities, perhaps particularly outside the US, strike one as being reasonably valued still at this point of the cycle.
Great. Well, thanks for sitting down with us today. It's been fascinating to hear your thoughts.
Thanks.
Well, that's it for another episode of Livewire's Rules of Investing. I hope you enjoyed the show. We've got some great guests coming up for you over the next month, including Rick Rule, President and CEO of Sprott US Holdings, and Peter Cooper, Founder and Chief Investment Officer of Cooper Investors. In the meantime, you can find plenty of great investing content on our website, livewiremarkets.com, or follow us on Twitter at livewiremarkets. And as always, thanks for listening.